Good morning. You may proceed.
I'll wait for Doug.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I forgot one of mine.
He's coming right.
Collins is back. If we can just wait till he returns, I'm sorry. Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is James Walters. I represent the petitioner cross-respondent Hard Rock Hotel and Casino. Your Honors, throughout the administrative litigation in this case, the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino has maintained two principal objections to the election and the conduct affecting the results of the election that occurred on November 6, 2009. Although there were two principal objections, they were totally different. One related to the challenge ballots and as a legal foundation, that objection sounds more in contract law, involving principles of interpretation, intent, consideration, and even breach. The other objection is, in a nutshell, board agent misconduct, and it's so highly unusual that it almost begs an analogy to tort law. Nonetheless, both were maintained and litigated in a hearing back in November of 2009. With regard to the challenge ballots, Hard Rock's complaint in a nutshell is that it did not get the benefit of its bargain. It signed, after some back and forth negotiation between the lawyer for the union and the lawyer for the company, a pro forma stipulation that did not have the word regular as defining part-time. These kind of stipulations are commonplace. The board estimates, I think, that around 90% of its representation cases are resolved by stipulation pursuant to Section 9C4 of the statute.
Doesn't have regular because you struck it or sought to strike it, correct?
Pardon?
Not just a, I thought it didn't have the word regular because you objected to the word regular.
We negotiated it out,
yeah,
Judge Ginsburg.
Right, it's not just, yeah, okay.
Right.
It's not insignificant.
But that word does appear in a whole lot of stipulations that do end up in elections.
It appears also in the community of interest analysis, correct?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And in a nutshell, Hard Rock was under the impression that it had bargained its way out of the community of interest analysis in this particular case in return for a shortened election time frame.
But I think what they found below, and I didn't see you really refuting it, it's ambiguous what you got when you removed the word regular.
It wasn't
as though you completely disposed of the issue. The language that left does not precisely deal with the question as to whether we're talking about on call or we're talking about people or we're talking about the dual the dual purpose of dual employees. I mean, it just, it doesn't answer the question. It could be on call.
We conceded that perhaps there was some ambiguity within the four corners of the two-page stipulation. We conceded that point, but we also relied on extrinsic evidence, namely of the intent of the parties. And we think we carried the day on that, but got a very brief, slipshod attempt at an analysis by the hearing officer.
I don't understand what your evidence of intent with respect to the other side is.
Well, the other side had an opportunity to refute Mark Ricciardi's testimony, which is basically I didn't want any magical formula or formulaic approach to, and the reason being is that this is an unusual hotel and casino in Las Vegas area. It's non-union and it's fairly large. You couldn't have cross-training or cross-utilization between the bell desk and the valet lane and the other properties because in most, the valet parkers are represented by Local 995 of the Teamsters and the bell desk people are represented by Local 226 of the culinary workers. That's in the opening statement. But the Hard Rock Hotel is unusual and kind of lends itself to this sort of uncharted area.
I'm not sure what it is you think to cure the ambiguity.
How to cure the ambiguity?
That the union agreed?
The union was either agreed or gave the appearance of agreeing up to
Well, that's the whole point, is that's ambiguous. I don't see how the board can be faulted for saying you didn't cure the ambiguity with the testimony. It doesn't matter. They didn't testify. They weren't obliged to, just like they're not obliged to say they can sit back on the Excelsior.
Oh,
I mean, the two of you were playing. I mean, there was clearly cat and mouse going on. No surprise. But it seems to me if you really wanted a specific thing, the answer to you is you could have gotten a very specific indication with no ambiguity at all.
A Norris Thermidor list.
Excuse me?
A Norris Thermidor list with names on it and signed off on.
I mean, just like Gala Foods where they got stuck the other way.
Yes, and yeah, we argued that to the board to no avail.
The problem is Gala Food doesn't help you because the evidence there was quite different.
Well, I thought the evidence was very similar, Your Honor. It was, you know, the Excelsior list.
And
then the company's attempt to renege on its agreement.
Yeah, which was in part supported by another written piece of paper from
by a piece of paper, which wasn't elevated to a Norris Thermidor list, but it was a sort of open the kimono sort of list.
I mean, the problem for me in looking at what the board can and cannot do is I don't think the ambiguity is cured. So you've got an ambiguous document, and we said what Excelsior, whether you respond to it or not, is not dispositive, and so the board can follow the steps that we say they're supposed to follow and analyze.
Well, our objection goes into that, Your Honor, and we claim they didn't follow their own case handling manual, which admittedly is guidance as opposed to legal foundation, but they didn't even do that. The case handling manual has three sections that we argued the board should have been followed. The first one, which obviously is easy, is there a jurisdictional issue that's a problem here? No, there were no airline employees or railroad employees. The next question, is it clearly inappropriate under the Act, namely the part-time as opposed to regular part-time? And the only clearly inappropriate under the Act would be something done in contravention of 9B1, for example, professionals and non-professionals, or 9B...
You're talking about when they get to the third step, community of interest?
Yes. I mean, there is no community of interest thing here. It's not clearly inappropriate to have part-timers in.
Well, but that's the whole question. The board's saying you didn't have them. There was no agreement to this effect. And so the board then is left with the community of interest analysis.
Which is what we were trying to avoid.
I know you were trying to avoid. I understand you wanted to avoid it, right? Because there's no community of interest.
There's no, under the board's standard test,
right.
There is no community of interest. At least it wasn't. I don't think it was proven that there wasn't. We didn't put in any evidence at the trial because that would have been, I think, sinking to their level. The evidence that the union put on was various people who worked the valet lane who said, well, I worked 40 hours a week, and during those 40 hours, I didn't see any of these people who were the challenged ballots working. I mean, we argued they could have been on other shifts. They didn't subpoena any of our records for people who worked the valet lane.
Well, I thought the evidence was about who supervised these dual employees, and they didn't share in the tip pool unless...
They, I think in the record it shows that if someone who normally worked the bell desk worked a full shift.
No, I just said.
In the valet.
But anyone who didn't work a full shift.
Did not share in the tip pool. I think that's standard industry practice.
Who drafted the version of the stipulation that had the word regular in it?
Who drafted it? It's a board document.
It was a board document.
It came out at the urging of the employer's council.
Employer objected to regular, and the union acquiesced in that.
The union acquiesced.
Pardon me.
We're simply trying to hold them to the benefit of.
So it says all rather than all regular.
It says all full-time and part-time. Mm-hmm. And looking at it just as clinically as we can, Your Honor, part-time means someone who has turned a shift or a part of a shift during a reasonable period of time going back from the election. I think that's, you know, it's not regular part-time, clearly, but it is part-time. The same kind of people that were allowed to vote over the employer's challenge in Gala Food Processing.
There's a passage in the restatement of contracts that I think fits this situation. I'm going to use the words employer and union rather than party and other party. If the employer had no reason to know of any different meaning attached by the union, and the union had reason to know the meaning attached by the employer, close quote, then the meaning attached by the employer controls. That's the restatement on this.
I think that's fine.
Your proof on that is what?
Pardon?
Your proof on that is what? That the union acceded to the meaning attached by the
Yes, employer. Mr. Ricciardi's unrebutted, uncontested testimony and the actual stipulation itself that was put into evidence.
Well, and the bargaining history of it with regular coming out.
The problem with regular coming out, I'm still not getting it. The board explained it pretty carefully, and you've acknowledged it. It offers two meanings. It clearly admits of two meanings in labor parlance. And in this context, when I read it, I did a lot of this. It doesn't tell me anything. With this group of employees, some of whom are dual, some of whom are on wait, and some of whom are regular, I don't know what that meant, regular or not. What does that mean? It could mean, as they say, the people who are routinely there, sometimes simply on call and otherwise regularly doing it, or it could be read more broadly to include anyone in the world who does it occasionally or not.
In this case,
normally that's not what part-time is.
Well, the board prefers, I think, regular part-time, because that denotes a sort of a
right.
Temporal consistency in scheduling and actual work.
Well, it also contributes to the community of interest finding, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it's part of the community of interest test, whether it's dual rate and so forth. But I think we made it clear that the community of interest test was not one that we...
No, I understand that, but if it had been left in, you'd be hard-pressed to claim that anything else
applied. We wouldn't be arguing that now, no.
You'd be stuck with the community of interest.
Exactly. Exactly. But I think there's a simple answer to that part of the objections, and that's all we've asked for all along, is to run the election over with or without a Norris Thermidor list.
Well, that's up to the board.
Secondly is the board agent misconduct, and this is even more troubling to us because it's something that just never happens. Board agents are giving election kits that are kept in their office, and they have observer badges, and they have personal IDs. And for whatever reason, this board agent had a bad day and didn't bring them, and there was admittedly enough confusion, we think, to establish that the laboratory conditions of the election were breached. The hearing officer, whether he was trying to help a temporarily disabled compadre or not, I'm not sure, but he conceded for purposes of our argument that the objections were that we had were of not providing IDs to the observers themselves, which is quote required end quote under the board's case handling manual. And there's also some question as to whether he had his own ID. Two witnesses, one company and one union, testified that he was wearing a white nameplate, whereas he testified that he was wearing his standard blue nameplate. So we're not sure if he was even properly ID'd, although granted he was wearing a suit and that made him probably stick out in this environment. But the hearing officer found you know, it's not clear why the failure, the admitted failure to give out badges prompted that kind of reaction from people saying they thought that the observers were all for the union. But he said, even crediting the confusion as fact, it's unclear whether that had a meaningful impact on the outcome of the election. I mean, he has admitted that confusion was part of it, and confusion was the reason the Eighth Circuit did not rerun or order rerun election in Nabisco. We think he got up to that point, and unfortunately, that particular argument not only didn't go anywhere at the board, it was buried under an unmarked tombstone of a footnote for an unwarranted credibility resolution. It doesn't appear anywhere in the board's decision itself that they even considered this. They treated it as a credibility resolution, and in fact, there was no credibility issues to resolve in this. Even the board agent admitted that he used the word fire, although his testimony was a little bit sugar-coated. But that's just something that doesn't occur. We think that's so unusual, if not outrageous, that clearly that's a breach of the laboratory conditions, and that the remedy for that is a rerun of the election.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear from the board.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, Barbara Sheehy for the National Labor Relations Board. I'm going to first address the challenged ballots issue and just quickly dispose of the three prongs that everybody's been talking about on the amalgamated milk producers. The first prong's been conceded on the ambiguity, and the third prong, as far as community interest goes, while Judge Roberts rightly points out that there was additional evidence in the record as to what the community of how to establish the community of interest, and rightly or wrongly, the employer's taken made a strategic decision not to contest that. So in any event, the community of interest is conceded. So it's really the second thing that I think the second part of the test that I think we're all sort of focusing on. I'm going to go to Judge Ginsburg about the restatement of contracts issue. And it's not the matter in this case, and I think the hearing officer made it clear, and the board in adopting that decision, it's not a matter of that it was as clear as what the restatement of contracts says in terms of the back and forth between the two parties, or here the employer and the union. And in fact, I think what's most telling is counsel here just said, and I think this is the focus of the hearing officer's report, hearing officer's recommendation, the union gave the impression that it acquiesced. In fact, if you look at how the hearing officer examined the evidence and examined the back and forth that really only went on for 2 days. They started having a conversation. It looks like the board produced the stipulated election agreement about 2 to 3 days before the actual election. And before that, so 2 or 3 days before that, you had the conversation between the union counsel and the employer counsel that the hearing officer described as fragmented and not particularly clear. And in fact, if you read the testimony of the employer counsel, it's not particularly long. If you read that, he is actually even unclear at that time what he said to who when, and whether he actually used the words dual rate, because that's going to be the problem where you're invoking the difference between the valets and the bell desk employees, whether he was actually using the words dual rate. He says he's not clear, for instance, when he spoke to the board agent when he asked for the word regular to be removed. He says, I don't remember if I said dual rate, doesn't remember a lot of details. And he also said when he was speaking, for instance, to the union attorney, he says that in their back and forth, he and the union attorney are talking about the stipulated election agreement. And he says, and this is a quote from his testimony, he said that the union wants to exclude so-and-so. And I made it clear I didn't want anybody excluded who parked cars. And I think what you have here is if he truly understood and if the conversation was truly as clear as the restatement of contract suggests it must be to sort of infer what a party intended by the contract, by the removal of words, that you would have had, I think, testimony from the company counsel saying something like in Gala Food, where he said, the union came back and said, I want Barb Sheehy excluded. And we know Barb Sheehy because we can then look at the lists and say Barb Sheehy is a dual rate employee. And instead what you have is sort of very vague testimony that the union came back during that back and forth and said, we want to exclude so-and-so. And his response was, I don't want anybody who parks a car to be included in the stipulation. And so you have what...
What's unclear about that statement?
Because, in fact, there's testimony in the record that it's not even just valet employees, the three categories of valet employees, and the conceded dual-rate employees who are on a contract. Basically, it just covers their compensation when they come over to the valet office. There are people in addition to those that park cars on sort of very unusual circumstances where the valet lot or the valet parking area happens to be very slammed. So it's not a matter of we're really only talking these two departments were the only ones parking cars. So I think for the union, for the employer council, when negotiating the agreement, to say I want anybody who parks a car, that's not even let's assume he did say that. That's not clear then that he wants everybody in the valet and that he wants everybody in the bell and the bell cap and the bell desk and the other people doing that. So I don't think it's clear for him to say, I want anybody who parks a car. I don't think that the hearing officer found that that wasn't sufficient to show that the union understood what it was that they were entering into by removing the word regular. And again, I would point out that again, you have what's going back
to kind of an odd argument though, because you're saying it could have included even more people.
No, I'm not sure that's exactly what I'm saying so much as it's not entirely clear. If I can hear that conversation.
But it's not clear because it could have included yet a third category.
Sure, so it doesn't necessarily go.
Is there any suggestion the union even knew about a third category at the time?
The witnesses were put on by both company and the union. I don't recall who at the time, no. There's no testimony.
Here's our last word on this through Judge Edwards. Referring to Avocor, the previous case before the milk producers. Avocor did not mean that any time a stipulation is ambiguous, the board must ignore it and turn to the community of interest standard. In a stipulated unit case, the board's primary responsibility is to discern the party's intent. That responsibility does not fall away at the first hint of ambiguity. Rather, the board should only turn to the community of interest test when it's unable to discern the party's intent from the stipulation, et cetera. Later on, I think, or maybe earlier, says when the contract is a nullity in this regard.
Sure.
A stipulation, I mean. So you think that we're without any guidance here, basically, even with extrinsic evidence?
I think what you had here, well, first, the board and the hearing officer did engage in the three-prong analysis that Amalgamated Milk Producer said it had to do, that you have to first decide, is it ambiguous? So otherwise, we're going to be confined to the four corners of the document. We're not at that point. Nobody challenges whether it was ambiguous. Then the board or the hearing officer moved into the second analysis, which was, can I infer from this document, and because one of the things that you can look for intent is the express words of the contract, and through extrinsic evidence to show what the parties intended. So the board, through the hearing officer, the board adopting the hearing officer's report, did go into that second analysis, and the hearing officer determined,
I'm wondering, did the employer at the time of the hearing suggest that an adverse inference be drawn from Stern's failure to testify?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I've read through the record and through the testimony. No, I'm not aware of that it was raised.
We'll let that stand unless on rebuttal it's questioned.
Sure. So you had the board go through the second prong and came to the conclusion they could not definitively determine what the party's intent was in the document. So that's only that's the point at which they kicked into the third part, which was the traditional community of interest.
It seems contextual to me. I think what trying to say is you can't discern the intention of the parties. They didn't have a meeting of the minds because they both had different objectives and they were playing games that are very usual in these circumstances. The union wanted to get a quick election. And so if I'm union attorney, unless I'm called directly on the question, you know, I'll let you do your blah, blah, blah. Unless you say dual rated employees have to be in the words, I'm going to lay back. The employer, on the other hand, as I look at it, wants to avoid the board hearing because they know they're probably going to lose on community of interest. So they're trying to get it as close as they can to what they want. But that doesn't show that they've joined in agreement and understand that each were going for something that was in their own interest but not consistent. The union obviously didn't want dual rated and didn't, as I read the record, it looks like the union didn't feel like it ever got called on the question. So the union attorney, I'm not saying anything. He didn't say dual rated. And the employer said, I'm going to try, see if I move a regular, even though I never got a direct concession from the union, I'll see if I can play that out. And they both were going for it. I don't know how at the second step that's agreement.
I'm not going to disagree with that. Unless there's anything else, I just have one quick point to make. Unless
the badges. There's... talk about the badges.
Sure. I guess the only point we wanted to make here was that the case handling manual, while it sets out sort of the ideal, we all realize that mistakes are going to happen. The badges are going to get left out of the bags. The kit's going to get put together, and it's not necessarily going to be as thoroughly put together as it should be. And in those circumstances, the board agent exercises professional judgment to determine how do I go forward, given what's gone, given that I only have one badge, I'm only going to wear two. But I think most significantly, so that really just goes to whether there's a strict adherence to the compliance manual, which there's not. I think everybody recognizes that it's a guidance document. But I think what's most important is the employer's failure to show that anything that happened in the polling station in any way, shape, or form affected the results, that it materially affected the election. There was no testimony from any witness that their vote was in any way affected by either the board agent's conduct as it related to the sort of the disruption that occurred or with the non-wearing of the badges. The most that you had was testimony that there was confusion as to who was who in the room, but you don't have anything from any of the employees who voted that suggested that there was any material effect. And in fact, the only voters in the room who even witnessed the event, the disruption, and whether there was a discussion about could he be terminated or not, the only people in the room at that time were ineligible voters. They were all dual-rated employees. There was one other dual-rated employee who walked in with the first individual, and then there was one on his way out. But all three of those individuals testified that they didn't speak to anybody about that altercation afterward. And in fact, the one who instigated the altercation said he left the premises immediately because his priority was breakfast. So there was no testimony at all that there was any effect on any voting individual. So with that, we'd seek full enforcement of the board's order. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, counsel for petitioner.
I have a couple of minutes left.
Yes, please.
I'd like to try to answer the question posed by Judge Ginsburg on the adverse inference issue, I presume. I think I'm knowledgeable about that because I was actually called in so that Mark Ricciardi wouldn't have to try the case, and that's why I ended up trying it. He was present in the hearing room on day two.
Stern?
Stern was, yes. But did not testify. He briefly cross-examined a couple of witnesses. Could have testified because his associate, Rudy Valderrama, was there both days, handling the bulk of the trial from their table. And I think an adverse inference is warranted in this case because Ricciardi did testify as to what his intent was, and frankly,
his subjective intent can't carry the day.
But I think
I'm in that situation, I'm listening, surprise. If I'm in his situation, I wouldn't have testified either. I don't think you've made it. I'm not going to put myself in any kind of harm's way. It's not there, and I knew that all along. He didn't have to testify. The only subjective intent you have is the company's subjective intent. That's not enough. That's not enough. I don't doubt that the company had that subjective intent. There's no question about that. But that doesn't prove anything but that.
Well, but then there's the other part. The union did go along with this, and maybe they're playing games and playing it better than we were, but they went along with this because there are certain markers which the regional office is supposed to revoke the stipulation if it appears as though there are going to be too many challenges. And, you know, within the four corners is the first one, and then when they receive the Excelsior list, which contrary to what is in the board's brief was not a few days before the election, it was 22 days. And then lastly, when the union has a chance to observe and approve the Excelsior list, which they did at the pre-election conference. So we're all pretending at that point as though these people can vote, and only when they've gotten the benefit of the bargain in terms of the shortened election time frame did they breach the agreement by avatar, basically, by having their observer secretly challenge the eight people.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Take the case under advisement.
No. Hold on, just